This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll hear from Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief from The Advocate. He'll be talking about this policy now of blocking banks from bonds. Headline, front page, above the fold in The Advocate. It may cost Louisiana some money. We'll talk about it with Mark Ballard. Also, today is the 125th anniversary of the birth of the kingfish, Huey Pierce Long, born in Winfield on this date in 1893. In 1918, 100 years ago, the great baseball player Ted Williams was born, a controversial man. One of his players, when Williams was managing the Washington Senators in 1971, was none other than Denny McClain. He's slated to be with us to tell his story about his association with Teddy Ballgame. And Fred Hickman, the legendary sportscaster who over the last 3 years has been a television anchor in Baton Rouge. He's moving on, and we'll talk with him. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. And as always, your universal number is 877-217-5757. You can call us in Baton Rouge at 297-5633. Matt Doyle is producing, and your email, if you'd like to send us a message in that realm, is talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Dennis Dale McClain, the last man to win 30 games in a major league season, 1968. It's been almost 50 years since that happened, and nobody's gotten more than 27 wins since then, so Denny McClain stands tall as a man who has set records that will probably never be broken. This is a different game we're in now. Pitchers don't even get more than about 30 or 32 starts, so it's hard to win 30 or even 25 or 20 games for that matter. But we're going to talk with him not only about the upcoming anniversary of his 30th win in 1968. He made the cover of Time when he was all of 24, MVP, Cy Young Award winner. But in the latter part of his career, he played for the Washington Senators. He was traded to the Senators in 1971, and his manager was none other than the great Ted Williams. And there's no doubt that Ted Williams was one of the greatest players in the history of the game. A 482 on-base percentage. That's even better than Babe Ruth. But as a man, a most complex human being, and Denny McClain, you knew him fairly well, and it wasn't all that pleasant, was it?
Well, Jim, good morning, first of all, and I hope you guys are getting a little cool off down there. Like we're finally only going to have a high of about 72 or 73 here today. And that's the first day that we've had like this in about 2.5, 3 months. It's been horrible up here. Anyway, speaking about heat and hot, Ted was a guy that was always in hot. He ran in one speed, hot, hot, and hotter. And he didn't give much about opinions of other people. He'd listen, but it was always be his opinion. And I'm not saying that, you know, when a guy is on base percentage of 482, it's tough to argue with a guy who's 482 career-wise. I mean, he hit 400 one year. I mean, and the strangeness about the year he hit 400, he was already hitting 400 the last day of the season. And he went up to the manager and said, listen, don't, because the manager was going to sit him down and let him be the last guy ever to hit 400. And Ted went up to the manager and said, listen, I'm playing today, right? He said, well, I was going to just sit you on the bench, let you come up one time as a pinch hitter, and that way you'll for sure be locked into 400. And he's, oh, no, no, no. He said, I'm not taking that way out. He said, my God, Ted, you've already hit 500 times. Who's going to complain? So the next thing you know, Ted says, no, sirree, I'm playing. And he went out there, and I think he either went 2-for-4 or 3-for-4. And, you know, and then what did he hit?
401, 406.
Yeah, he was a man's man, I'll tell you that. He went twice to the war. He was a true hero. Both times he left the game of baseball making some pretty good money at his level. And lo and behold, he went out twice. And came back two times, and, you know, you can't say enough great things about him in that part of his life. And then on the other hand, of course, he just was I thought Denny McClain was opinionated. Denny McClain is a pimple on a goat's butt compared to his opinions, because his were in gold in some form, and you couldn't penetrate one of his opinions. It was impossible. He was just a different guy, walked to a different drummer. Once you got to know him, he was okay. At that time, I owned an airplane. And once he found out I owned an airplane, and that, it took about 3, 4, 5 months for some reason, he come up to me and says, can I get a ride from you down to, I think it was Savannah. He said, I got a speaking engagement tomorrow. I'm not sure if I can get back for the ball game. And I said, how do you think I'm going to get you down there? He said, well, you got an airplane. I said, you're kidding. He says, no. He says, can I? I said, I'll buy the gas. I said, well, I said, I don't care about the gas. I said, but are you serious? Are you kidding? He said, no, I'm serious. So the next day, we put him in the airplane, and on the way back, we let him fly left seat the best he could, and he did a hell of a job. I mean, you know, it's airplanes, I think, a lot like bikes. It's once you learn how, it's always the easy to get back on that bike and start pedaling again. So he did a good job. Another 8 or 10, 12 times he flew in it, too. So he had a good time. I can't say we became friends, but I would say that we became real good partners in a ball club that wasn't going anywhere. That was sure, because our ball club, we couldn't catch it, couldn't hit it, couldn't hit a cutoff man. We just had one of those ball clubs that comes along. Everything is cyclical, but this cycle must have lasted 40 years with the Washington Senators. And I just wondered, because I got traded the next year to Oakland, I just wondered when that was going to end, and it ended when obviously they moved to Texas, and then a lot of great things happened.
Well, he spent part of 6 seasons in the service, 2 wars, World War II and Korea.
Yes.
An amazing guy in that he piled up big numbers, 19 years, 19 All-Star appearances, by the way, 2 Triple Crowns.
Big.
But he was a left-handed hitter, as we know, in Fenway Park. And in his last at-bat, he homered. And as usual,
right.
he refused to tip his hat to the crowd. He didn't like fans, and some of them didn't like him despite his greatness. He was, as I stated, a guy who was a bit prickly, wasn't he?
Oh, at least a minimum prickly. One other thing that's real important to point out. The guy, they had once my father-in-law was the manager of the Cleveland Indians at one time, Lou Boudreau. And Lou, trying to stop Ted from hitting .500 against him year after year after year, put the Boudreau shift in. Lou is the one, my father-in-law, is the one that put the Ted Williams shift in, moved everybody over to the right side of the infield when Ted would come up. Ted refused to try to hit the ball to left field, by the way. He would never lay down a bunt. He would never try to hit the ball on the ground to the left side of the infield. He was going to beat you the way he was born and bred. He was going to beat you with a line drive base hit someplace. And in most times, he did. That was the kind of guy he would not take. Nobody else's answer really counted until, they got him out once or twice. And he was very seldom did he ever give compliments to anybody, because he just thought when they got him out, they were just damn lucky.
Well, in that 71 season, your record, of course, was not good, 10-22, but your pitching was better than the record. You had 3 shutouts that season, and I think about 12 complete
games. Yeah, it was tough year.
But you were with Curt Flood. Curt Flood, another pivotal figure in Major League Baseball. And Ted didn't get along very well with Curt Flood, did he?
No, he didn't get along with Ted at all. He wasn't, Ted was, Curt was one of the guys that came over in a bunch of confusion to begin with. But when he came over, he was supposed to put some butts in the seats. He did it first. And he could still play. That was the amazing thing about Curt after taking a year or two off. He could still play the game. And nobody could figure out why Ted wouldn't let him play 9 innings, 7 innings, 8 innings. To this day, I don't have an answer for anybody. Other than they had words in spring training a couple of times. And as a matter of fact, I was there with the one conversation with 5 or 6 of us standing around in the outfield waiting for one of the sport magazines to take some pictures of spring training in that year. And I'll never forget what Ted said. Ted said, and I just want all you guys who want to be stars to know one thing. There's only one star on this team, and he stands in the middle of all pictures. with my mouth, I said, well, who's that, Ted? Which was the wrong thing to say the least. He said, who the hell do you think it is? And I said, well, I've got a hunch. I said, but if I get a guess, I'll take the first one. So it was always ramble and catch the bunny, It was have a lot of fun with him at times, but I don't know if he ever laughed, belly laughed. I'm not ever sure if he ever belly laughed. He had some good laughs, I think, at other people's expense. Not that he was mean-spirited, But that was just Ted. Ted played all the time. He played 24/7. Ted is the guy that they say originated taking your baseball bat back to your room when you were traveling on the road and getting the 5 or 6 or 7 extra pillows and have them brought up to your room and tie the pillows with a belt around a chair and just swing in your room all day long for an hour or two or three. So he gets a lot of credit for a lot of things. But one thing he could do, and that's what my father-in-law said, Boudreau, he said, he's the best hitter I ever saw. He says, the only guy I've ever seen, he said, that could hit the ball down and away as hard as he could hit the ball down and in, up and in. He said, the man was unbelievable. He just had the quickest. Mm-hmm. And see, they blame his eyes. It wasn't his eyes. It was his hands. Good hitters have great hands. They throw their hands at the ball. Good hitters throw their hands at the ball. That's what makes them so good. And the guys who have the quicker hands are the guys that play better and hit better. And Ted just had those hands. I mean, he was, and he could talk hitting. He could talk hitting for hours. The problem was he got so, what would be the word? He got so technical with the swing, the pitch inside, the pitch down, the pitch up, the this, the that. He lost you after about 10 minutes. boy, I tell you, if you had him in your life and you were a hitter, at least on the edge of being a hitter, he'd be the guy you'd want to coach in you. That's one thing for sure.
Born on August 30th, 1918, 100 years ago, Theodore Samuel Williams in San Diego, California. He died 5th of July, 2002 in Florida, and his body has been preserved, frozen cryonically. Ted Williams apparently was a believer in this sort of thing, and we'll see what happens. His son, John Henry, who spent some time in Baton Rouge, has also passed. We'll be back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Baton Rouge, it's 297-5633. And you can always send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Coming later in the show, we'll hear from Fred Hickman, who is a legendary sportscaster in his own right, perhaps at one time the best-known sportscaster in America. And Fred, the last 3 years, has graced the airwaves in Baton Rouge, an anchor at Fox 44 and Channel 33, and he's leaving to go back to the Washington, D.C. area, and we'll miss him. He is quite a talent and a fine man, Frederick Douglass Hickman. So we'll hear from him. Also, Mark Ballard, the Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate. And today also, in addition to being the 100th anniversary of the birth of one Ted Williams, it's the 125th anniversary of the birth of Huey Pierce Long, born August 30th, 1893, in Winfield, Louisiana. Huey Long served as governor for a very brief time before he was elected to the U.S. Senate, and his time as governor and in the Senate, and by the way, he was still more or less the shadow governor when he was a U.S. senator. It was from 1928 to 1935. So you can see, in 7 years, he dominated the world stage. He was a major radio presence with millions of listeners every week back in the infancy of radio before there was television. And Huey Long was definitely a threat to become a challenger to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the year of 1936 when FDR was seeking a second term. Huey would have been challenging him from the left. But nonetheless, Franklin Roosevelt ended up serving 4 terms. He carried Louisiana every time, but in Louisiana, it's hard to believe that anybody would have defeated Huey Pierce Long if he had been on a ballot for any office after 1928. His rise to prominence came right after the birth of Edwin Washington Edwards, born in 1927. He was a baby when Huey Long was elected governor, and it came after the Great Flood of 1927 that John Barry has written so elegantly about, and that flood perhaps triggered the election of the Kingfish in 1928. We're talking about the Great Depression when this happened, and Huey Long was a man who had tentacles that went far and wide. He basically kidnapped the band leader of the Roosevelt, Castro Carrazo, from his post at the Roosevelt and brought him to Baton Rouge and made him the LSU band leader, and Castro Carrazo ended up spending the rest of his life at Baton Rouge because the Kingfish wanted it that way, and he generally got his way. He is a member of the Music Hall of Fame in Louisiana, the Hall of Fame run by Mike Shepherd, the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. Huey Long is in there as a songwriter, and one of his songs has been recorded many times, and once by none other than Randy Newman. Here's a sampling of Huey Long's music and Randy Newman's rendition of a song that is famous far and wide. Newman with the Huey Long song, Every Man a King. And I think Denny McLean has had to step away, so we are pleased to now bring back to the microphone on Talk Louisiana Fred Hickman, who was, as I stated, along with Nick Charles, they were huge, with a capital H, back in the day. And it is always a pleasure to visit with Fred Hickman. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for that insightful interview with Denny McLean that brought back a lot of memories.
You and I are of the same vintage, and we remember the day when Denny McLean won 30 games. I stated, Fred, that that's not likely to happen. He had 41 starts that year, completed 28, threw 336 innings. Now they count pitches, and the pitchers don't pile up those kinds of innings, and as a result, they don't win as many games.
No, they don't, and that's never going to happen again. So that was, as you said, that was a vintage era, and I also remember Mickey Lolich, the portly left-hander.
Yes.
I think that's the first time I ever heard that term, but he was great on that ball club, and that 68 World Series was tremendous. So it was just a pleasure hearing him talk about Ted Williams, who I don't really remember seeing play. I didn't see him play in his prime, but the stories I've heard about him were he was just all about business, all about baseball, loved his country, served us twice in the military as a pilot. And I think, now, when Denny spoke of the hand speed and the whole thing, getting to the ball, I think that's absolutely true. But I think that his hand-eye coordination was what really made him such an effective hitter. You couldn't sneak anything past him at all.
No, and he walked mainly because pitchers didn't want to pitch to him, but he wouldn't go for pitches out of the strike zone as some mm-hmm. batters do, and as a result, his lifetime batting average was .344, and then you combine that with a number of bases on balls. This was a period in baseball that he dominated with two triple crowns, but there was nobody who had those kinds of numbers as far as walks to strikeouts. No slugger. I'm looking, Fred, 2,021 walks in his career, a record broken by
wow.
Barry Bonds, but only 709 strikeouts in
And the thing with Barry is that just nobody wanted to pitch to him because it was pretty much going to turn into a rocket if they did. For any number of reasons, which, you know, can be discussed and in different ways, but really nobody wanted to pitch to Ted, and he just wasn't going to bite. He was the original, you can't sneak a piece of cheese past a rat guy.
Left-handed batters always look better to me. That swing, Bonds and Williams, Ruth, and most of the most of the greatest players have been left-handed hitters.
Reggie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's always a beautiful thing when they have the act together, and as you stated, hand-eye coordination, none better than number nine, Ted Williams. Now,
yes, sir.
Fred Hickman, we want to talk about you. And before we get to your new gig, and you'll be leaving Baton Rouge in probably just a few hours or a few days. At one time, I don't think I'm overstating it. I think you and Nick Charles were the best-known sportscasters in America.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. We worked and we battled, and we never thought of ourselves in that way at CNN. We started in 1980. We launched CNN. We were there from day one. And Nick unfortunately passed away a few years ago from cancer after a long battle with it. But he was a great friend. And we, at one point in time, and I don't know who figured this out, but we had the longest running tandem show of anyone ever, which included Lucy and Desi.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know who CNN figured that out, but they did. So I got a plaque sitting around in here someplace in the box.
That is a great story. And we'll talk more and hear some more stories from Fred Douglas Hickman after this pause. 877-217-5757 is our number. Now the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF.
Louisiana Radio Network, I'm Jeff Palermo. One of the most conservative members of the Louisiana legislature says he's supporting the unanimous jury verdict constitutional amendment on the November 6th ballot.
The amendment may have started off as a liberal pipe dream, but ended up snowballing into one of the few major changes to state policy that is garnering substantial bipartisan supporters, like ERATH Representative Republican Blake Miguez, who says his conservative values inform his and the Louisiana Republican Judiciary PAC's backing of the move.
We can't take any chances when the government is taking rights away, and we need to be 100% certain, and the only way you can be 100% certain is to have a 100% unanimous jury verdict.
I'm Matt Doyle.
A new state education department report on academic achievement finds students are progressing at a faster pace in English language arts than math. Also, historically disadvantaged groups like black students and students from low-income families demonstrated the top growth statewide, but more needs to be done to close the achievement gap with peers. Louisiana Radio Network.
At Honda, our legendary ATVs and Pioneer side-by-sides are designed to help you face every challenge so you can seize the day. And now, at the Honda 4-Wheel Clearance Event, you can make the most of today while saving serious money with amazing factory-to-dealer incentives on our most popular models. Hurry in and seize the day. And the deals, only at your Honda dealer. For your safety, read the owner's manual. Wear a helmet and eye protection. Always wear your seatbelt, and for side-by-sides, keep the side nets and doors closed. Pioneers and ATVs are for drivers 16 years and older. Factory-to-dealer incentives are good with select new and unregistered models. Dealer participation may vary. See dealer for complete program details. Offers end 10/31/18.
Luba.
Luba.
Luba Workers' Comp. It's how you pronounce more dividend checks, lower rates, and going the extra mile for employers who purchase workers' compensation coverage from us. At Luba, we understand the importance of providing reliable excellence in customer service. That's what we call genuine dependability. It's that proven quality you deserve. Learn more about the Luba difference at lubawc.com or call your independent insurance agent today.
This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. And Fred Hickman is our guest for another segment. The legendary sportscaster turned news anchor in Baton Rouge the last 3 years. And he's about to head off to the Washington, D.C. area with a job in Hagerstown, Maryland. Big area of the country as far as people. And, of course, that usually means more people will be watching and hearing Fred Hickman. But over the last 3 years, he gained quite an audience at Fox 44 and Channel 33. Fred, it all began for you at Coe College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and you worked there for KCOE-FM. I bet that was a low-power station.
9 watts FM mono.
I think when I was at WPRG at LSU, it was 8 watts, so you beat me by a watt.
Well, I was the music director and general manager at the station, if you can call it that. And I had some T-shirts printed up that said, less power than the common light bulb.
How many,
I wasn't wrong either.
How many cities have you lived in since the late 70s when you were in college and just getting started?
Gee. Well, I grew up in Springfield, Illinois. And when I graduated from college, I went back to Springfield for 2 years. When this crazy guy, Ted Turner, called me and said, yeah, well, we got this thing going on down here. Why don't you come down? And I was there for the best part of 22 years, I guess, with a two-year respite in Detroit, 84 and 85. So I was there for the World Series for the Tigers. And then it was off to New York, which is right after 9/11. And I was there for 3 years with the YES Network working for the Yankees. And then off to ESPN, which is in Connecticut. Back to Atlanta, where I worked with the Atlanta Braves. Then off to New Orleans in 2011. Where I was sports director over at the Fox station there. And then my good friend Gary Werblau is the news director here, and a brilliant guy, brilliant man, brought me over, and we decided, well, let's do some news. And I said, well, yeah, that's kind of my, you know, forte. Oddly enough, people know me for sports, but I've always been a political junkie. I've been a, you know, a person who loves to study and ask questions and be curious about what's going on in the world. So it's been wonderful. The 3 years that I've spent here in Baton Rouge, I've made some wonderful friends. My wife Sheila and I both have. But it's been interesting. We've had the shootings. We've had the Alton Sterling incident. The unfortunate incident with our officers and
the
deputies
flood.
Being
the flood
shot
as well.
And wounded. And the floods, yes. Some turbulent elections and some debates, which I was pleased and privileged to be a part of conducting. So it's been a wonderful ride here for 3 years, and so off we go. You know, new adventure, new chapter.
When you arrived here, it was right in the middle of the gubernatorial campaign of 2015, mm-hmm. and you moderated perhaps the most memorable debate of the season between John Bel Edwards, after they got in the runoff, John Bel Edwards and David Vitter. That was an electric night, wasn't it?
That was a crazy night. The one thing I remember, and it kind of sticks out in my mind that the crowd was in the auditorium was evenly split, and they were very vociferous. But the thing I remember about Governor Edwards is that he was sitting there kind of tapping his fingers on the table before we even started, and he was giving the stink eye to David Vitter, and I thought, well, this may turn into go time before we're all done. Which it didn't, but it got a little robust. Let's leave it at that.
And the governor, he used his West Point training, and he found his opponent's weakness, and he was not reluctant to talk about prostitution. And David Vitter, of course, didn't like that a lot.
No, he didn't like that at all. The most vivid, well, I won't quote it, but I'll paraphrase it. But he said, Mr. Vitter came with a thing, well, what about the party bus in New Orleans? And the governor shot right back. He said, yeah, I was there with my wife. And I was like, oh, boy, here we go. Here we go.
Yeah, and you had a studio audience, and that's tough.
And it was Yeah, it was, and my colleagues that were there, we couldn't hear a thing. We could hear nothing, but and our backs were to them. And I'm thinking, wow, in my sports background, I was thinking, I hope they have some Andy Frain guys back there to keep people from throwing stuff. But it was pretty, it was interesting and a great moment of growth for me. But the one thing that I've learned to love about Baton Rouge is that people come together. When the officers were slain and wounded, that was such a touching and moving time. To see folks across all lines just come together in support. And I think that goes a little bit underrated. I think that there's such a divide in the country today, black, white, Republican, Democrat. I don't see that. What I do see is I see a collective movement toward peace and understanding. And I hope that's the way it's going. I really do. And I think that's going to be, that's going to be the only way we're going to survive. We're going to have to do that. But I'm very proud of this city. I'm proud of its citizens. It's come a long way. It has an awfully long way to go. But a part of me is always going to be here in Baton Rouge.
You've lived, as noted, in many other places, including some of the biggest cities in the country, and you've traveled extensively as well abroad. Does any other city remind you of Baton Rouge?
Oh, gee. I would say Atlanta a little bit. All deference to Saints fans, relax.
Atlanta's a great city. It is a great city. So
it is a great city, and it's a melting pot. Our children were born there. But it is a melting pot as far as the U.S. is concerned, because there are people from everywhere that go there. And it's hard to find somebody who says, I'm from Atlanta. I was born and raised in Atlanta. It's almost kind of rare. I think in Baton Rouge, you're getting to that point with LSU, with all the folks who had to come over from Katrina, which we just observed the anniversary of yesterday. My partner and colleague and dear friend, Sean Burns, is born and raised here, and she has taught me immensely about the culture of the city and how to say things like Bergeron instead of Bergeron.
<Yeah. laughs>
I remember the worst ribbing I ever got was during Hurricane Isaac when we were in New Orleans. And I go to this town for hurricane coverage. I had never been in a hurricane in my life and don't like them at all. I would like to not see another one. But Robert. And I'm thinking, Robert, of course. No, it's Robert. Of all the things, why would this be Robert? But Sean has talked me through many of a name that I could not decipher, and she's a wonderful person. So I'm leaving you in good hands with her. She's going to be terrific.
She was with us a few weeks ago, and she is a delightful person. Worked for all the major stations here. Now, you're heading to Hagerstown, Maryland, as mentioned. That's a substantial market, and it's close to Washington, mm-hmm. D.C.
Yes, it's an interesting place. We are literally a couple of miles away from Pennsylvania, West Virginia. We're in Maryland, and Virginia is right there, and we work into the Washington, D.C. market. So it's a four-state area. I can't imagine the politics are going to be any less crazy than they are here. But it probably will get a little bit frenetic as we get into the midterms here. So I'm very much looking forward to that. So yeah, it's a big challenge. I'm going to also be serving as managing editor, which is good because I want to be able to coach up the young guys and gals who are coming along in the business that need to know about storytelling. We have what is known now as MMJs, multimedia journalists, and that's great. You know, they're teaching our young people how to, you know, manipulate video cameras and edit and tweet and all that other kind of stuff. But what they're not teaching people is how to tell the story.
Well, we'll be back to wrap it up with Fred Hickman as he wraps up his 3-year tenure in Baton Rouge. We will miss him, but phones work. We'll be in touch and we'll talk with him some more and also hear from Mark Ballard of The Advocate. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're wrapping it up with Fred Hickman, and then we'll move on to Mark Ballard, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the newspaper of record. And let's see, we may have lost Mr. Fred Douglas Hickman, so let's see if we've got him or if, nope, it's time to move on to Mr. Ballard. But we thank Fred and wish him well in his new endeavor in Hagerstown, Maryland. Fine gentleman. Mark Ballard is with us. And today he has the top story in the newspaper of record, The Advocate. Blocking banks from bonds may cost Louisiana. Officials unsure of financial impact after panel bars institutions over gun policies. What's going on here, Mark Ballard?
Well, there was a lot of writing within the trade publications about what the impact of banning the two largest banks from participating in the Garvey bonds. This is the money that they're using for the widening of the I-10 and the entrance to get into the Louis Armstrong New Orleans International Airport. And so there's been a lot of speculation as to what that political statement means or will mean to the taxpayers who are going to be paying for these bonds ultimately. And I think what we find is that, right now they don't know for sure that there is the possibility that it's going to cost us more, but maybe not that much more, but they don't really know for sure. And I think that's what has a lot of people uncomfortable right now.
Well, the state, as you know, hopes the bonds will raise enough money to widen I-10 in Baton Rouge, and that's something that we certainly need. Attorney General Jeff Landry, though, along with Senator John Kennedy, they have been vociferous in describing their displeasure with the gun policies. Landry calls the corporate policies fascism at best. And this looks like it could be a prelude to the governor's election next year, Mark.
Oh, I think that's exactly what it was. They were looking for a little wedge to get into what is a pro-gun governor right now, and they were trying to find something in which they could say, oh, well, but he's not for this, therefore he's anti-gun. This also was on a national level when Citibank and, Dick's Sporting Goods and Bank of America and a lot of the major retailers were coming up with restrictions on the sales of guns. They caught a lot of backlash, and I think this was also kind of an outgrowth of that.
Well, it's going to be quite a ride if either Jeff Landry or Senator John Kennedy run against our governor, John Bel Edwards, who is seeking reelection, and it will not be an easy ride for the governor, no matter which of those two runs, and it appears that probably one or the other will. In Landry's case, though, he has to give up his job as attorney general, which would seem to be somewhat unlikely. Kennedy, we're still waiting.
And I guess I've been saying it for months now, but I think we're going to continue to wait for John Kennedy to decide what he's going to do, and it's probably not going to be very soon in which he's going to do that. I think that whoever runs against the governor it has an inside track because, after all, we are in a ruby red state. At least on the statewide elective positions, and the governor, while popular, is a Democrat.
Well, this week the biggest story in America has been the death of John McCain, the senator from Arizona, and today's Advocate. That is an amazing shot on the front page of his widow, Cindy, with her head leaning against the casket, an aerial shot, shot from above the casket, and it's a poignant shot, a poignant photograph, Mark. It doesn't get much better if you're a photographer. It's taken by Ross Franklin of the Associated Press. It's quite an image.
I was wondering how he got that as well. Of course, I've never been in the Arizona State Capitol, so I don't know if there's anything hanging over or if it was one of those drones or something. But it was a powerful shot. And I think, you know, that there has been a lot of outpouring and rethinking since the senator died, because he was one of the legitimate heroes of the U.S. Senate.
We saw Gene Mills of the Family Forum at the Press Club Monday. Mark covered that story, and President Trump on the same day met with evangelical leaders and warned of violence if the GOP loses the House. In Louisiana, it appears that the incumbents are probably in fairly good shape.
Yeah, I think so. The president is embarking on, I think it's like 40 different stops. It's as if he's campaigning again to try to save the House. A far more aggressive schedule than any president has ever done before, and he wants to protect the House from having the Democrats take over, which nationwide is a possibility. I mean, the math is there. I really don't think that Louisiana is part of that, and we note that though he seems to be going everywhere, the president seems to be going everywhere, he will not be coming to Louisiana, presumably because everything is copacetic as far as he's concerned in the Bayou State.
But he probably will be here next year for the governor's election, and quite likely will be at the side of John Kennedy if he is the candidate, or another Republican, although President Trump has been largely... he's been largely complimentary of the Democratic governor. He's called John Bel Edwards his favorite Democrat.
Well, yeah, I read that and have heard it, but I'm wondering if he's going to, you know, if the party, the partisan part is going to play a part in that, you know. But he does seem to genuinely like and goes out of his way to compliment Governor Edwards. If you've read some of the transcripts of those meetings that they've had, you'd wonder, you know, if Trump was a Democrat, because he is very complimentary of Governor Edwards.
Well, a decade ago, Donald Trump was a Democrat, supporting people like Andrew Cuomo and Hillary Clinton. And, of course, now, as we know, he is a ranking Republican. And I don't think it's a stretch. I've heard it several times this week that the Republican Party, until further notice, Mark, it's pretty much the Trump Party. He is driving the agenda, and we don't hear any Republicans, both in Louisiana and around the country, really going after the president on any number of fronts in which they could.
Yeah, and that is quite noticeable. I mean, and that... They don't go after him when the press conference in Helsinki, when he was kind of supportive of Vladimir Putin. You know, we saw Garrett Graves kind of criticized him, but nobody else kind of came out and said, "What in the world is he doing?" At least among the Republicans, they just have not stepped up and been critical of the president. I mean, the way they would have been if Hillary Clinton would have won. So you're right. Until further notice, it's going to be the Trump Party rather than the Republican Party.
Today in The Advocate, another story in the Section A about the president and his veracity. Media hesitant to use lie. Trump statements often called falsehoods or distortions. The story from David Bauder of the Associated Press is that President Trump has been accused of dishonesty, spreading falsehoods, misrepresenting facts, distorting news, passing on inaccuracies, and being loose with the truth. But does he lie? In the past, journalists, even if they thought somebody was telling a lie, they wouldn't use that word. But with Trump, even the New York Times has called him a liar a few times. It is a new world in which we're discussing this president.
But we need to kind of remember that throughout history, really, I mean, going back to John Adams almost, is that the politicians, the elected officials, have always had a difficult relationship with the media, with the reporters that are basically say, "Gee, is that really what's going on?" And they get very angry about it, and they are also very the politicians, I've noticed over here at the state capitol, can say lots of things that are not out and out lies, but are leading me to believe something that may not be totally accurate.
I think it's fair to say the media and the governor of Louisiana have gotten along well, but recently he has taken a blistering for some of his appointees, Jeff Britt and Johnny Anderson, back in the news. Both of those, I think the governor may very well regret having appointed them to high positions.
I think so. I think so. Maybe he could tear a page out of President Trump's playbook, and who's had troubles with some of the folks that he's appointed as well. But we're accused, the media, Louisiana media, is accused of being, you know, in John Bell's camp, but that is, I don't believe is necessarily true. I know that the governor gets quite angry often with the coverage that he suggests that is not as polite as he would like to see it.
And you have, by the way, Mark's column will appear Sunday, and Mark is a down-the-middle kind of guy, but you have a couple of right-wing flamethrowers on the Sunday pages, editorial pages, and Jeff Sado, who's on this show occasionally, and the gentleman who used to be a reporter at Channel 9, Dan Fagan. They don't mince words when they're criticizing the governor of Louisiana.
This is true. This is true. This whole idea that there's some sort of liberal cabal in the media has always shocked me, because there seems to be far more the conservative point of view that is.
All right, we do have to roll, Mark, but as is always an honor, we'll talk with you next week if things go well. Until then, thanks for listening and stay tuned.